This is The Guardian.
I'm Noor Haidar, coming to you from Gadigal land, and this is the full story.
Because I reckon someone's planted a bomb.
This is not a drill. Your safety is paramount to us.
When a homemade bomb was allegedly thrown into a crowd of more than 2,000 people at an Invasion Day rally in Perth last week, police said had it gone off, it had the potential to cause mass casualties.
Please head back for Forest Chase. We must clear the area.
But in the hours and days that followed, many questioned how police, media and political leaders responded to the alleged attack, and criticised what they said was selective outrage that dismissed the violence and racism First Nations people face.
There was a lot of anger, I think, that this wasn't being immediately investigated as a terror offence or a hate crime, that people felt targeted, that this was, you know, a man who has allegedly thrown a homemade bomb into a crowd where it was mainly First Nations community gathered.
Today, Indigenous Affairs correspondent Sarah Collard on the bomb threat at Borloo and the sadness and fear that lingers. It's Tuesday, the 3rd of February.
Full Story is supported by Australian Industry Group, Australia's largest and most experienced industry association. From workplace laws to skills shortages and compliance, Australian businesses face challenges every day. Supporting over 60,000 businesses nationwide, Australian Industry Group is Australia's trusted business partner for compliance, advocacy and growth. Members enjoy the benefits of instant HR and legal advice, along with access to a team of experts in workplace relations, compliance, legal, skills development, apprenticeships and more. Whether you're shaping strategy, managing people or driving operations, Australian Industry Group exists to help businesses of all sizes thrive. Learn more and join today at australianindustrygroup.com.au.
Sarah, welcome back to Full Story.
Thanks for having me.
So last week, a homemade bomb was allegedly thrown into a crowd of First Nations people at an Invasion Day rally in WA. Before we talk about what happened and the response since, you have family, you have friends in Perth. How are they feeling?
There's a lot of shock and anger and fear and anxiety. Like, my family is, a lot of them live in Perth and surrounding areas. As a Noongar woman, I've got connections to Perth and that area, obviously. So it's hit quite close to home, and I think it's really quite shocking. Like, my sister was there, and, you know, the family and friends, they go to the rally every year, and it's always held in Forest Chase. So I think it's been really scary, and I think it's been something that a lot of people are still processing, really. Like, yeah, in the days that followed, it's, you know, really dominating conversation.
Mm. And you and our colleague Douglas Smith have been speaking to people who were in the crowd at Forest Place, who witnessed what happened and then the immediate response. Can you describe what happened that afternoon through what witnesses have told you?
Yeah, so Douglas and I have spoken to a lot of people over the past week, and community and family and friends and elders and community leaders were there. And, you know, there was a lot of people gathered there. There was around 2,500 people there for the rally and the march. And what we know is that, you know, around 12:30, it's alleged that a 31-year-old man had thrown an attempted bomb in the square, and it hit just near the stage, which is where, from people that I've spoken to, have said that that's an area where there are a lot of children and families present, elders and more vulnerable people, because that's where it was kind of segregated from the main rally. So people that, you know, perhaps weren't as mobile as others, who needed seating and, you know, things like that, they were all sitting there. So there was a lot of fear that, you know, had this gone off, that it was, it could have really impacted really, you know, vulnerable children and elders and families. A lot of people were quite excited about going. As I said, there's a lot of people that go there, and it's a really an event where people bring their kids, their aunties, their elders, and it's a chance to kind of get together, allies come together and show that solidarity, and as well as that strength and resilience for families and community in Perth.
So when this device or object is thrown into the crowd, what's the response like at the time?
So when it was thrown, a lot of people weren't quite sure what it was, and they were thinking, you know, is it a coffee cup or a bit of rubbish that's kind of blown in from the wind upstairs? But it hit a girl's leg, and she kind of looked at it, and then she alerted the authorities, and they kind of came and had a closer look and expected it. And basically that was when they realised that the threat was very real, and they started immediately rushing over. And people have told me that it was quite chaotic, that, you know, police had formed like a bit of a line, that they were really strongly urging people to get out. But a lot of people didn't actually know why, because they didn't want to panic people. That's what they've said, that, you know, there's a crowd control measures that people have to do. But there was also a lot of, I guess, distress and anger that people weren't quite sure what was happening. You know, some people weren't aware until that afternoon that it's actually a bomb threat.
And this object has been described as a homemade bomb. What else have police said about the threat that it posed to the crowd?
So this was a device that had allegedly was filled with a flammable liquid, that it was filled with ball bearings, screws, nails, kind of like shrapnel, that if it exploded, it's designed to cause maximum injury and impact. And police have actually said that had this gone off, that they could have been looking at, you know, a mass casualty event, that it had the intent and the ability to cause serious injury and death.
Okay, so you mentioned earlier that police arrested a man, a 31-year-old man, at the scene, and on the following day they announced that charges had been laid. What do we know about this person and the charges that he faces at the moment?
So we know that he's a 31-year-old man from Perth's northern suburbs. Because of the suppressant order, there isn't a lot of details that are known about him that can be publicly revealed. He has been charged with intent to do harm and making or possessing explosives.
Sarah, you just mentioned that there is a suppression order in place around the identity of this individual. Why is that?
So his lawyers have successfully argued that they believe that there could be some sort of threat to his public safety. So because of that, there's no details being available. So if, you know, people share his image, his name, anything that could identify him, where he's being held in prison, they're breaching the suppression order. Now, we don't know the circumstances of why that is. Obviously, when there's been other incidences that have been related to this, such as, you know, there's been incidences in the news recently where, you know, people have made bomb threats or attempted devices and terrorism-related defences and things like that, where they have been publicly named. And I think a lot of people are wondering why that is. You know, obviously there are circumstances where, you know, as I said, that they believe that there is a threat to his safety, and so that's why his identity is being suppressed and his identity is being protected. But in previous examples, where in WA at least, we've seen suppression orders argued on this ground. So Elijah Doherty was a young boy that was killed in an incident. He's alleged attacker, his identity was suppressed. So there is a history, I think, of certain cases where, you know, we see this happening in First Nations communities where their identity is suppressed.
After those charges were laid, many First Nations people and their allies started to become quite vocal about what seemed to be a soft or subdued or muted response from police, politicians and the media when compared to other similar incidents. And I certainly started to see in my social media feed more people raising concerns about this. What were people telling you at that moment in time?
There was a lot of anger, I think, that this wasn't being immediately investigated as a terror offence or a hate crime, that people felt targeted, that this was, you know, a man who has allegedly thrown, you know, a homemade bomb into a crowd where it was mainly, you know, this First Nations community gathered. And I think there was a lot of anger that hadn't been immediately labelled or investigated or probed as something like that. You know, I think it was later that night that police and, you know, they announced that this was being at least investigated as something that may be terror related, and they were still obviously probing that, and the investigation is still ongoing. Obviously, ATO and joint terrorism officers are working with WA police now to kind of ascertain any kind of motive or ideology that may be behind the attack. But certainly, you know, speaking to people and family and communities, there was a lot of feelings that we hadn't seen the same kind of, you know, outpouring of anger, of solidarity. You know, it was seemingly missing in action. I think I've spoken to a lot of people who they came to work the next day and people hadn't heard of it. They didn't know about it. You know, they're like, oh, what happened? Mm. And I think people hadn't seen it hit, you know, it wasn't on the front page of news. It wasn't really being talked about. You know, a lot of it was focused on this record breaking heat that we've been seeing, you know, and people were like, why aren't they talking about this? We could have died.
I do just want to step through this, Sarah, because the homemade bomb was allegedly thrown at midday on Monday the 26th, and it wasn't for another 48 hours later that authorities then announced that it was being treated as a potential terrorist act. There was that joint statement that you referred to by WA Police, the AFP and ASIO. Can you tell us a little bit more about what they said?
So they haven't really revealed much about, you know, the motives and the ideology behind it as yet. Like, they've mentioned that it's in the early days of the investigation, that they believe that he acted alone, that there's no ongoing threat to the public. His home was searched, and it's further alleged that there was chemicals and materials found with, you know, making and manufacturing a homemade explosive was located, they're alleging. His bail was refused, and he's due to appear in court late this month on the 17th.
And Sarah, police also met with Indigenous groups and leaders on the Wednesday. Do we know what happened at that meeting?
Yes. So they met shortly thereafter, you know, just a couple of days after the attack. I think there was a lot of fear and anxiety and anger in the community that this wasn't being treated as seriously as perhaps it should have been initially, or I think there was certainly that perception amongst community members. Community leaders met with Police Commissioner Cole Blanche, and basically they raised their concerns around what they felt was the real targeting of the community, the fear and anxiety this was stirred up, and that they wanted this to be very seriously treated. And it was an opportunity for senior community leaders and elders to meet with police and really frankly share their concerns. And, you know, speaking with elders that were there, they said that it was a frank and quite a productive meeting, that, you know, police were quite open about, you know, some of the challenges that they'd had in, for instance, just kind of getting people to clear the square, for instance. Like that took quite some time because I think people were frightened that they were actually closing down the rally, and there was a bit of concern and fears that I think it also goes some way to show up the distrust that is still there and the historic kind of factors when we think about Aboriginal people and police. And I think that there was a lot of fear around that. So it was really about coming together and airing those concerns, people having that opportunity. And I think it was something that a lot of people appreciated. But there was also concerns around the fact that people who held the rally weren't at both events. That was more higher level community people rather than some of the grassroots younger people that had organised that rally. And so I think, you know, speaking to some of those people, they also want the opportunity to meet with police and kind of talk about those concerns.
We'll be right back. So a lot of questions, Sarah, being raised about the police response, the media response, but also the political response. What can you tell us about how politicians, both in WA and nationally, have responded?
Yeah. So that was something that a lot of people had spoken about, that they felt this wasn't being politically condemned, and the language was quite muted, and it took a little while for that to really reach communities' ears. The Prime Minister, Anthony Albanese, says that, you know, this was quite a shocking incident, that he believes that the full weight of the law should be thrown at this man as is appropriate. Obviously, once this is further investigated for the courts, we saw the Minister for Indigenous Australians coming out, you know, the next day saying this was a really serious incident and that it was shocking, and she understands, I guess, the worry that this is. And I think there's been a level of quite reluctance to engage from some sides of politics in WA, for instance, as well, nationally.
Sarah, as you've said, this has drawn comparison to other incidents where there has been a far more immediate and muscular response with swift press conferences called, front page news sometimes for days, and a loud chorus of condemnation. You've worked in newsrooms across the country and you would have seen the way that authorities and newsrooms respond to incidents like this. Why do you think this has been different?
I think a lot of people have felt that this hasn't kind of reached the mainstream news, that we haven't been seeing it lead the top of bulletins, that it hasn't been really the kind of intense coverage that we've seen in other events. And I think that is something that has been frustrating people, you know, that why isn't it making the same kind of headlines and news that other incidences that are also provoking fear and anxiety and feeling of a sense of being targeted. And I think for a lot of people, they've noted that level of difference. And I've certainly noticed it, you know, just reading through the news and watching the news coverage over the last week. We haven't really seen that kind of national coverage and that outpouring of condemnation, the solidarity from politicians, from media outlets and things like that. It's been quite different. You know, it's been obviously a very busy news period, but I think for a lot of people, that's a sign of the times that this isn't having the kind of cut through. And I think a lot of people have felt that this incident has really spurred from the recent rise of white supremacy, of racism, that we really saw an unleashing of toxicity after the 2023 referendum. And that's just something that has been continuing. And this is the culmination of this kind of outpouring of hate that our communities have been facing over a few years. And I think when it isn't being called out as strongly and forcefully as it should be, then that's a real fear that people feel that, you know, that we're alone in this, and there's not the same sort of solidarity that we're seeing in our communities. So I think that is a really real concern that people are feeling.
Well, Sarah Collard, thank you so much for your time, and we'll likely check back in with you as this case develops. Thanks.
Thanks, Noel.
That was Indigenous Affairs correspondent Sarah Collard. You can find more of her work on theguardian.com, and we've linked to her latest piece with Douglas Smith on the Full Story page. Indigenous Australians affected by this event can call 13 Yarn on 13 92 76 for information and crisis support. This episode was produced by Joe Koning. Sound design and mixing by Camilla Hannan. The executive producer of Full Story is Hannah Parks. Don't forget to subscribe or follow Full Story, and you can also leave us a review. I'm Noor Haidar. Thanks for listening.